Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The economic impact from the COVID-19 pandemic is severe and could linger for some time.
If current levels of unemployment persist for many months, then we could be into what he termed a much more serious situation.
Contributor John Hurl takes a look at where things stand now and the path that lies ahead. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also check in on the fate of summer camps during the coronavirus crisis and what it means for families once the school year ends. Artist Playlist focuses on a new outdoor public art project from the Delaware Contemporary. And Enlighten Me features work from student journalists at the University of Delaware, produced during the pandemic. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware is set to begin phase one of its reopening plan June 1st, and in the interim is embarking on what Governor John Carney is calling a rolling reopening, a series of baby steps that allow some segments of the state and its economy to ramp up even sooner. The hope is to start getting the economy back up and running and avoid long-term damage to it. Contributor John Hurdle this week takes a look at where Delaware's economy is right now and what impact these initial steps may have on bringing it back in sectors like restaurants and hospitality. His piece is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss it. Well, the biggest takeaway I get from your reporting this week is something that I think we've seen with a lot of other things regarding this reopening, like community pools and houses of worship, and that is just because the state is allowing something to reopen, it doesn't mean everyone involved will. And you saw this a bit with restaurants and things that you checked into, right?
That's right. Yes, I spoke with three restaurants in different parts of the state, and they all told me that they will not be opening for sit-down customers on June 1st, as they are now permitted to by the governor's order. I spoke with one restaurant owner who's got four locations in Delaware, another two in Pennsylvania. He said that that he's decided he is not going to offer sit-down service as of June 1st because they're only allowed to operate at 30% of capacity. And this restaurant owner said that he simply can't make any money operating at less than a third of his regular sales level. So I spoke with another restaurant owner with two locations, one in Hockessin, another one in Newark, and he said that he was actually equally concerned with the idea of bringing some of his customers coming back and seeing other customers sitting down and eating their food, and he said that there's a certain proportion of his market that is still very nervous about the idea of getting infected or reinfected by COVID if they go into a relatively crowded place like a restaurant. And so he's very worried that those people are going to stay away, and he thinks that he's hoping that there will be a gradual increase in consumer confidence, and as more and more people get to see that it's possible to start to interact with folks, then they might be prepared to go back into restaurants. But he thinks that that's going to be a slow process, and that he's going to wait until phase two of the governor's operation, which these restaurateurs hope is going to allow them to operate 50% of their capacity.
Is there also a concern on their part at all about being able to provide the safety measures you need to provide to not only keep your employees healthy, but again, and maybe inspire that confidence? Is that also something that they've got to kind of work into their equation?
Well, indeed it is. The folks that I spoke to were very very clear that they will be taking additional measures to clean their restaurants and to let their customers know that they are doing that, and so there would be much more aggressive cleaning of the so-called high contact or high touch areas, which would be potential sources for any resurgence in this infection. And so so they're going to be working very hard to let their customers know that they'll be taking these extra precautions.
So you mentioned the restaurateurs being a little concerned about consumer confidence. Do we have any other sense of kind of what the general feeling is about consumer confidence and how much a role it will play in bringing the economy back at this point? That, you know, are people really willing to go out and not just go to restaurants, but go anywhere and engage in any way with the economy at the level that's necessary to get things going again?
Well, I think that there's you might see that there's some kind of mixed messages here, because I mean, at the same time that states like Delaware are beginning to reopen, beginning to allow businesses to reopen, they're also saying that people need to do so very carefully and need to wear masks and need to continue to observe the social distancing restrictions that we're so familiar with now, and so I think that you know, a lot of people, some people, who knows how many, I guess this coming Memorial Day weekend is going to be very telling in this regard, but there'll be a certain section of the public that will be very leery on this, and so we'll need a kind of careful nurturing in order to feel more confident about going into places like restaurants, bars, or retail stores.
Is there also a sense of urgency that's maybe even a bit more pronounced in southern Delaware by the beaches, where restaurants and other businesses connected to tourism are kind of in a race against the clock to make something of the summer season that unofficially starts with Memorial Day weekend?
Well, indeed. I mean, it's no secret that the that restaurants, bars, hotels, anybody connected with the any businesses connected with the tourism industry have been particularly hard hit by these shutdowns, and of course Southern Delaware is very dependent on the tourism industry, and the region was actually singled out by Patrick Harker, who's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. He spoke in a conference call last week that was hosted by the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, and he mentioned Southern Delaware as an area where, you know, there could be a lot of long-lasting damage to tourism-related businesses.
We've talked a lot about restaurants and hospitality, both now and in previous reporting, and with good reason. They've been very, very hard hit by this whole thing. But are there some other areas that are facing big issues right now in terms of staying on stable grounds economically?
Well, yes, absolutely. President Harker did focus in on a couple of those areas. One is the so-called EDS and MEDS, that is educational and medical institutions, which together are very economically important for Delaware. Create approximately 17% of the state's workforce, and one of the problems with educational institutions is that they're having to deal with the needs for social distancing and wrestling with the question of whether to give all of their classes online, as far as on the medical institutions, they are suffering from the fact that they've got the increased costs of treating COVID patients, coupled with the fact that they have cleared away any folks who are waiting for elective procedures, and so therefore those institutions are for the moment deprived of income from those sources. So President Harker was talking about the Federal Reserve is considering a series of making loans directly available to at least the educational piece of that cohort there. The other thing that one other sector that he drew attention to was commercial real estate. I think it's fair to say that the jury is really out on that. I mean, some companies might be considering having more folks working from home on a permanent basis, and therefore they would need less office space. But on the other hand, employers might also be required to create more space in their buildings so that individual employees could remain socially distanced, and so that's a scenario under which employers could actually need more commercial space. So I think so those are two ways in which the commercial real estate industry could be affected.
We should note, of course, that Governor Carney has said that hospitals and other facilities can start doing elective surgeries again, but like with everything else, just because people can do them doesn't necessarily they'll happen right away. And so that financial impact on hospitals is likely to kind of lag a little bit. John, I also wanted to ask you about unemployment numbers. We talk a great deal about that. How well do these unemployment numbers tell the story of how bad things are right now in terms of jobs in the economy?
Well, I think the context here is key, Tom. I mean, as you mentioned, even though we've seen in the very latest jobless figures that they've come down a little bit, but they are significantly lower than they were earlier during the pandemic. They're still around 10 times the level they were before the shutdowns. And so it's also worth looking at the total number of people who have filed for first time unemployment claims since this began, which is up around 95,000 people, which is somewhere around 20% of the Delaware workforce. And so this is a put in that context this shows that the extent of the economic damage that's going on here.
So when we take all of this in, what is the outlook? How deep a recession could Delaware face, and how long could it last?
Well, I spoke with Jim Budkovitz, who is a professor of economics at the University of Delaware, and he has puts the latest situation in the context of the Great Depression. It's a subject as an economist that he's studied, and he points out that in the Great Depression that the lowest point of unemployment that was in 1933, unemployment went to 25% nationally. Now, if we take the latest national numbers, the unemployment rate for April was 14.7%. But Professor Bartkowitz says that for a number of technical reasons, he suspects that the rate is actually a lot higher, and he thinks it's probably around about 20%, which is sort of getting up there towards these Great Depression levels. So he, of course, is very wary about making any predictions about how this is all going to play out or when we might see any relief to this, but he does warn that if current levels of unemployment persist for many months, then we could be in for what he termed a much more serious situation.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. You can read his reporting on Delaware's economy and its plans to reopen right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We examine the impact the COVID-19 pandemic will have on a summer staple, summer camps. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Many summer staples, like a trip to the beach and hanging out at your community pool, may be significantly altered or completely absent this year due to the coronavirus crisis. The same is true for another summertime tradition, summer camps. But this could have a bigger impact on some families who rely on camps not only to give their kids something to do once school lets out, but to offer them something with educational value as well. Contributor Larry Nagengast recently spent some time looking at where summer camps stand as the state starts to slowly reopen. His piece is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he learned. So let's start with kind of just getting the lay of the land. Some camps are just kind of throwing in the towel. Some are not. Which ones are already saying they're not even going to try to open this summer, and what's their rationale for that?
Well, okay, first of all, I have checked a lot of websites. I've made a number of phone calls and email inquiries, but you know, I certainly didn't contact every camp operator throughout the state. I mean, there are dozens, though, probably hundreds of them. But anyhow, with that caveat, I can identify at least three significant camp sponsors that are shutting down for the summer. The Girl Scouts of the Chesapeake Bay, Hagley Museum, and Camp Arrowhead, which is a program of the Episcopal Diocese of Dover of Delaware that has been running in Lewis for 65 years. Now, I did talk to Walt LaFontaine, who's been the director of Camp Arrowhead for many years, and he gave me a number of reasons for shutting down for the entire summer. Overall, as the staff at Arrowhead considered alternate plans, they concluded that the restrictions that are now in place would have made it impossible to continue many of the activities that have been signature portions of the camp's traditions for years. And then there were all sorts of uncertainties, whether the counselors that they hire from overseas would be admitted to the country on time due to both coronavirus and immigration restrictions, and whether they can secure needed cleaning supplies. I mean, you just think about, you know, getting enough Lysol wipes when you're dealing with 1,300 campers throughout the summer, not to mention the safety risks to both the campers and the counselors who during their free time would typically spend a lot of those hours in crowded resort places like Rehoboth and Ocean City. So, you know, you add all that together and they've got very good reasons for saying, hey, you know, we just can't get this done and do it right this year. So, and I think if you ask anybody else who has already decided to shut down for the season, I'm pretty certain that, you know, they'll give you similar explanations for what's behind their decisions.
Having said that, the ones that are holding out hopes to move forward, what's kind of the timetable for deciding whether they can or not? Like so many of these other things that we're reporting on these days, it seems it's very much tied to the state's reopening plan, right?
Yeah, there's no consistent timetable here. And the operators are telling me that they want to make their decisions anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks ahead of the scheduled starting date for a particular camp session. They need those couple of weeks there to do a final setup, make sure they've got everything in order. And they also don't want to surprise families by making last-minute cancellations. Now, the state's reopening plan doesn't allow camps to operate during phase one, which is supposed to start on June 1st and is expected to last at least 2 weeks. So that means that the earliest any of these camps are likely to open would be June 15th. However, if the camps don't open then, from the people I've talked to, it's far more likely that the sessions aren't going to start until right after the 4th of July. As you said, the openings will be tied to the state's reopening plan, and we don't know yet what Governor Carney's phase two is going to be like, when it's going to start, and whether summer camps are even going to be allowed to open during this phase two.
But just based on what we've seen so far from the governor's plans, if these camps do open, they're going to face a lot of considerations they don't normally face, largely dealing with what you alluded to earlier, with safety measures. And these are no small issues, right?
Well, no, they're not small issues, but fortunately, all of us are getting used to some of these changes in different aspects of our lives already. But it will be a first-time experience for the summer camps. You know, we're looking at things like curbside drop-off and pickup for the campers, temperature checks, hand sanitizing stations at check-in and all other sorts of places on the campsite. The number of campers is likely to be smaller, maybe on the order of 30% of what the normal camp size is, and they're going to be organized into smaller groups. And you can expect that the camps are going to have new rules, things like you'll have to bring your own water bottles with your name on it, no sharing snacks, things like that. You can expect that counselors are going to be wearing masks. And even the day camps, operations that are much smaller than Camp Arrowhead, are going to have to make sure that they've got enough sanitizer, enough cleaning supplies, and so on in stock so that they can keep their program safe throughout the summer.
How about virtual options? Are they on the table for some of these camps to convert like the schools did for the school year?
Yeah, absolutely, and to some extent, the people at the camps are learning from what the schools have done as the schools ventured into distance learning this spring. Several camp operators are considering going down the same path. Two of the most notable that I spoke with are Delaware Technical Community College and the Delaware Museum of Natural History. They're both working on virtual programming that they could use if they're not allowed to open on site, and I'm pretty certain that there are going to be others that are thinking the same thing at this time. Virtual camping is not going to mean doing 6 hours of video that looks like what a camp day would be like, rather it's going to be a case of essentially programming experiments, projects, putting that on video, and then being able to do these exercises, projects at home. And that's going to be done with parents being able to pick up kits of learning kits from the camp, a couple of days before the camp starts, so that they've got all the needed materials at home for when the kids are working on those projects. I mean, so essentially what the virtual program is going to do, it's going to bring summer camping experiences into your living room and into your backyard.
You talked to a few parents for your story. How do they feel about this situation? I imagine there's some trepidation, particularly around things like safety that are so front of mind for everybody.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Safety is paramount for just about everyone. The parents that I talked to made the point that they know what they're doing to keep their own kids safe, but they can never be sure what other parents are doing. So they're being quite cautious. Part of being cautious means that they're thinking about only sending their kids to camps that they know about, camps that have operators that they can trust, that they've had experiences with before. And the camp operators I talked to say parents are hitting them up with safety questions. What are the precautions that they're taking to make sure that their kids are going to be safe when they do arrive at the camp?
But not having camps to send their kids to could make for a long summer for families if kids feel cooped up at home after already remote learning at home since March, right? I mean, this is something I'm sure some parents are fearing.
most definitely. And I mean, by now, we've certainly all heard accounts of the challenges that parents are facing while they're working from home and they're having their kids also at home from school doing classwork at the same time. So you got parents and kids sharing computer time during the day, parents doing double duty as teachers, parents working well into the evening to get their the work for their own jobs done, things like that. It's fair to say that a summer without camps is going to be much more of the same. Parents dealing with work stresses while having to keep the kids active and functioning in a way that they don't get bored.
And there's another piece to this too, Larry. I mean, many camps offer value, kind of beyond just being a place for people to park their kids, educational value, some other things that parents value about the camp experience. Is that something that parents you talk to are also worried about losing those things?
Oh yeah, most definitely. I think Richard Gordon, who is one of the parents that I talked to, summed it up very well. And here's how she put it. She said, camp isn't just a place to put the kids. We see it as a way to make new friends and to learn new skills. So if you think about it, maybe it's music, maybe it's dance, maybe it's swimming or computer programming. Summer camp can be an opportunity for youngsters to learn new talents that they wouldn't necessarily pick up during the school year, or to focus more intensively on one of their passions and get even better at it. No summer camp for many kids is going to mean a missed opportunity that they're never going to have a chance to make up.
But I guess maybe the good news here is that chances are this is a one-year issue. Unlike some other areas affected by the pandemic, no one expects camps to face long-term damage or changes, do they?
Not quite sure, but you know, let's put it this way. You know, we've all heard talk about a second wave of coronavirus in late summer or the fall. And if there's a second wave, well, might there be a third or even a fourth? You know, the fact is we don't know. And if there are multiple waves of this virus, what we see this summer might possibly be repeated next year. But it is fair to say at least these two things. First, in a planning or predictive sense, no one is looking that far ahead, looking at next summer right now, because we've got to get through this summer. Second, being realistic, a lot of us are recognizing that what has become our new normal in the last 2 months may very well continue being normal for us for months and even for years. So, yes, I think the expectation is that camps will return to what passes for normal operations in 2021, but that normal might include lots of hand sanitizer, lots of daily temperature checks, as well as thousands of kids making new friends, learning new skills, and creating for themselves memories that are going to be quite different from what they're unfortunately having to experience this year.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. You can read his reporting on the coronavirus pandemic's impact on summer camps at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist and a look at a new outdoor public art initiative coming to the Delaware Contemporary next month. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Museums across Delaware are getting creative with their efforts to keep people engaged with them during the coronavirus pandemic. At the Delaware Contemporary in Wilmington, staff used the time it's been closed to work on the launch of a public art initiative, and now that project is about to come to fruition. The Delaware Contemporary plans to unveil the Platform Gallery during an Art Escape drive-through event Friday, June 5th. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with the Delaware Contemporary's Executive Director, Leslie Schaefer, about this exterior gallery concept.
Hey, talk to me about this event, this Art Escape drive-through event coming up on Friday, June the 5th. What is this all about?
Thank you for asking, and it is pretty exciting. We, on behalf of the staff and the board, have been working on this pretty hard from home. Various different homes. It is the launch of our public art initiative. And so for many people who have driven by the Delaware Contemporary, we are in a now celebrating this year 20-year-old steel-clad building. And we've thought for many years about how to enliven the exterior and our little corner of the riverfront, Wilmington. And so for the past few months, we've been in conversation and had finally commissioned a series of artists to work with us on a public art initiative. And those artists will be creating large scale, and I'm talking really large scale, 30 by 30 feet, 28 by 28 feet, banners that will be installed on the exterior skin of our building. And so what is now a metallic finish will be enlivened with these bold, beautiful explorations of contemporary artists' ideas. And so the first artist that we have commissioned who will launch what we're now calling the Platform Gallery, we've even named our exterior space because it will be an ongoing program. And additionally, for those who may know this or who may not, we are right along the Amtrak train line. And so as you're pulling into the Wilmington station or you're pulling out of the Wilmington station, you are going at a very slow speed past our building just a few feet away. And so we thought it was a perfect opportunity to really engage Wilmington to the millions of people that travel up and down that Northeast Corridor every year. It's also accessible from I-95, so we're in this really great, very visible position to get artists' work out there. And so what better time than now to make sure that it's up while we're all shuttered away? And while we all can't come inside the museum, we can all experience it visually from the safety of our vehicles. And so we decided to have a drive-through. So we have created a route that goes down Madison Street and then across West Street and into our parking lot that we share with the Navient building. So a viewer will come into their car. They will see the largest banner, which is facing our West Street side of the building. And then they will pass through our entrance where there is another very large, I believe that one is about 20 by 16, back behind the building where they'll get the similar view from a lower vantage point of those who would be traveling on the Amtrak station. What's really fun about this first program is that the artist, and her name is Teresa Cromati, she has also developed a soundscape. And so we've put that soundscape together along with some interpretive material from the curator that is available to the public using a QR code so they can scan it with their phone and with their cell phone and hear it as they're driving past the work and the way that the artist might want you to experience it.
So kind of music to go with the art.
Kind of. It's some sounds, and she works with a performing arts group that she likes, and they recorded, I think, each banner project, each work of art has a three-minute sound piece. If you were to get out of your car, you know, when we all can get back to normal, there'll be speakers outside of the museum that are on the ground, you know, in the landscaping area, and then at our entrance where you could hear a similar soundscape. So yes, it's background, but it's related to, you know, her way of seeing the work, you know, her environment for us as viewers. So that is kind of a fun element to it.
Let's remind people we're talking to Leslie Schaefer. Leslie is the executive director at the Delaware Contemporary. Some fun and exciting things happening due to the fact that the Delaware Contemporary is shuttered right now because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Leslie, the artists that you've been talking about that are doing these scenes, are they all Delaware artists? How many of them are there? And talk about some of the scenes that will be on the building.
So the first artist, her name is Teresa Cromati. She is a Baltimore. She grew up in Baltimore. She is Guyanese American. Her father's Guyanese, and she lived in a very tight-knit community of Black women in Baltimore that really influenced her work. She then attended DCAD. So she's local in that she lived in Wilmington for a couple of years while she got her degree in actually graphic design, and then went on, as many DCAD students do, to finish her education at Pratt in New York, and that's where she is now. She's very young. She's well under 30, but although she's emerging highly successful, her work is very bold, very colorful, very abstract, but really powerful. There's a lot of tension in it, and you really feel that kind of push and pull, especially in a time like this where we're all very kind of unsure about how we are responding to everything around us. Everything has changed. And I think, honestly, for her, when she probably came up with the idea a few months ago through the process of creating it, she as well as shuttered in New York, she will have been challenged, you know, to really think about her concept. Her idea here is about that power struggle, the power struggle of who's authored, who's given permission to represent the female form. She was chosen because we are, like many other institutions across the nation, celebrating the centennial of the 19th Amendment, and she fit well within that. What do the struggles of women today feel like? You know, how do they respond and relate to women 100 years ago, what they were trying to accomplish? And so in her very own abstract painterly way, she's commenting and continuing that conversation on how women are represented. So we're really excited to fit her in here. She's she will be very much on site. We're hoping to get her involved with a lot of our regular programming, especially programming with DCAD and getting the students that are currently or at home or hopefully back into their studios next fall some time with her to talk about that very next step, because she's really only a few years beyond them.
Yeah, I was going to say, is Teresa the lone artist or are there others?
Each of these projects are 6 months in duration. These projects have been curated by Kristen Heilman. She's our curator in residence. And the next artist that will come up in this conversation, in this series, her name is Anna K.E. And then she will launch her work in December. So Teresa's work will be up from June 5th through the end of November. And then mid-December, Anna K.E. will don the outside of our building, followed by that next June with our first male, and that's Malika Mugosi. So we have three artists for the next 18 months commissioned to do new projects, and they're all very, very different. K.E., Anna K.E., who's also part of our centennial celebration, deals with digital imagery as well, and somewhat, but in a very different way, addressing the female form. So each of these artists, to some degree, are figurative, but abstract in very different processes and approaches. What's really fun, I think, about the June 5th event, and I encourage everyone to go, you know, we can't get out to do art loops, and art loop is something that we've really been successful with at the Delaware Contemporary. It's an opportunity to have the artists in the galleries open up their new shows, and here the city is taking precautions and, you know, trying to maintain these social distancing with the possibility of opening art loops not until September. So right now, September 11th is the next art loop on the calendar for the city. So this is an opportunity for us to, you know, start thinking about getting back together, but do it in a very safe way. We will have music that you can hear outside of the soundscape when you finish listening to the banners. We have an interactive car-based art activity that you can participate by tossing something at a canvas that has been conditioned, shall I say, with some mysterious reveals. So the more people who come in, the more will be revealed. And, you know, you'll get a sense of what's to come for the museum in the future.
This sounds like such a fun event, an art escape drive-through, if you will, event coming up on June the 5th at the Delaware Contemporary. Leslie, anything else coming up this summer, interactive or virtual-wise, that the Delaware Contemporary is doing since you remain shuttered for the near future?
We had a couple of shows that we have... we're still planning to hopefully get the work in, and they may be virtual. We may not be open to the public, but as always, over this last couple of months, we've made them available both through video and through online interactive activities. You can get in and see those. So Cheryl Warwick, who is a Philadelphia-based artist, will show her work. We've extended Ellen Priest, who's a local abstract painter, until August. Her show opened right before we closed. And so she had, I think, about a week of public access, so we will keep her work open. But then two more pretty exciting things happened. While we were closed, we opened up social media competitions, opportunities for artists to submit work via Instagram. And we've commissioned a juror to make selections for a virtual exhibition, a social media exhibition. Those will be then shipped to us, and we will put those in our galleries, and if we're open, people can come in, and if not, again, we'll see them virtually. But there were, I think, almost 400 submissions to our social media opportunity for artists to show in our space, and so that's what our summer will look like. Additionally, for those who may not know, we have 26 studios on site, and artists guests who are part of our studio program will submit work and we'll put together a show for their work that, again, may be virtual, may be live, depending on how things go. Maybe a few people at a time if we are able.
Thanks to the Delaware Contemporary's Executive Director, Leslie Schaefer, and our Kelly Steele for bringing us this week's Arts Playlist. More information is available at decontemporary.org. And a quick note, during the June 5th Artscape drive-thru event, all guests will be required to remain in their vehicles at all times and adhere to the state's regulations requiring social distancing because of COVID-19. And stay with us. We wrap up the show next with Enlighten Me, where we highlight student work from the University of Delaware produced during the pandemic. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Occasionally, The Green takes time to highlight work created by student journalists, including those at the University of Delaware. And while learning during the spring semester moved completely online at UD, these students continue to tell stories about issues and topics they find interesting and important. They just did it remotely. In this week's Enlighten Me, we are highlighting a series of pieces produced by UD communication students for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, longtime First Aid journalist, director of UD's Center for Political Communication, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. To these students' credit, they have been able to produce thoughtful, informative pieces without the usual access to equipment and interviews they would normally have when working on these stories, which makes them all the more impressive. We start with junior Yusra Asif, a communications major who went home to India when the COVID-19 pandemic closed UD and had to attend class online at 1 a.m. local time in India. Her piece offers a snapshot of what life under quarantine looks like in India during the coronavirus crisis.
Sounds of the birds chirping and the leaves rustling is the closest one can get to any proof of life here in India's usually cheerful city of Ahmedabad, which now resembles a ghost town. In the southwestern part of the city, an apartment complex with 7 buildings is normally brimming with the laughter of children playing in the complex's central garden. The garden is empty now, the chairs vacant as the residents seek refuge from the coronavirus in their homes. Rais Mistry, a 52-year-old man who lives in one of the buildings, describes the situation.
The whole building was locked down, and slowly and gradually, you know, people, the to and fro, going out, coming in, everything was locked, and it was hard, very hard.
People's daily routine has dramatically changed. Prajapati, who works as a watchman here, has now been tasked by the police to keep an eye on anyone who goes out or comes in.
I keep entries here in my notebook. If someone goes out, I record the time, the name, mobile number, their vehicle number, where they are going and for how long.
Sonia Sankala, a housewife and a mother of three, describes in her native language of Hindi how her life has taken a different course.
My routine was to drop my kids to school every day, but now we are completely locked in our homes. My yoga and walking, everything has been postponed. On the other hand, I'm really happy that my husband gets to stay at home. Now I get to make him delicious food every day, but he keeps nagging me all the time.
It's not just the residents. The Ahmedabad police have received a list of new duties to impose the city-wide lockdown. Mahendra Singh, the police inspector who is in charge of this apartment complex, explains.
We are constantly monitoring people. We have quarantined entire families who have tested positive. Part of our job is to check on those homes every day. We make sure that these households get proper food. We also regulate social distancing rule.
This catastrophe has impacted every life, some in a manner kinder than others. The lockdown in India is expected to continue at least 2 more weeks, the third extension, squashing people's hope to get out and to be free.
Before the quarantine, we were like eagles. We could fly anywhere.
Yusra Asif reporting.
Thanks to UD Junior Communications Major Yusra Asif for her reporting. Next up, we hear from UD Sophomore Communications Major Mia Pellegrino, who takes a look at the remote learning experience from the perspective of a college student and the university professor.
For a generation raised with computers and cell phones, the move to online learning may seem like a piece of cake, although it is a trial and error process, one that some students are finding difficult to adjust to. Sophomore Alexa Parisi is in a dual degree biology and physical therapy program at Seton Hall University. Before all this, she used to wake up at 9 a.m. and grab Dunkin' with her friends before heading to class. But now, she rolls over in her bed, still in pajamas, to watch pre-recorded lectures. Alexa has been doing this for about 3 months and tries to keep up a schedule as much as possible. Now living at home with her parents, an older brother, and a dog, Alexa finds herself getting distracted, often disrupting her focus.
I try to have breakfast and I drink coffee. And then depending on my classes, if I have a break in between the two, I'll try to like do a workout or take a walk with my dog.
She misses her friends and even going to class.
And now being home, I'm not really able to have that same connection with my fellow classmates. We don't really study that much together. It's harder doing it over FaceTime and stuff. And also it's just hard not being in the classroom setting because it makes me feel a little unmotivated to study as often as I did at school.
Many professors opted to pre-recorded lectures rather than real-time Zoom calls, which leaves it up to the students to watch on their own time.
It's easy to not be as engaged as in the classroom. There's a lot of distractions. You might be on your phone more. It's not like you have a teacher watching over you.
Maybe not watching over, and maybe not in English, Frau Busch uses her German class to check in on how her students are doing.
They say, gut, good, or nicht so gut, you know. And then if they say nicht so gut, I go to English to establish a level of comfort. And I ask one or two students, you know, what's going on? Tell us. And maybe that makes other students feel better by thinking, oh, you know, I'm in the same situation.
Frau Busch empathizes with what's lost for her students and for her own experience in the classroom.
When you're not in a community, when you're not, you know, you don't have that casual chit-chat at the beginning or after class, or you're too shy to bring up a point during class because you don't want to interrupt the Zoom class. And college is more than just classes. College is, it's this big social experience, and you're missing out on that, and that can be quite demotivating.
And something Alexa Parisi echoes.
And I just feel that I'm missing out on a lot of opportunities and experiences for my major and to become a physical therapist.
Mia Pellegrino reporting.
Thanks to UD sophomore communications major Mia Pellegrino for her piece. And we wrap things up with senior John Cassidy. The communications major with a journalism minor examines the state of marriage in the United States, who's getting married, who isn't, and why.
Wealthy Americans still say I do. Middle-class Americans, not so much. Multiple socioeconomic factors have led to lower marriage rates among the middle three-fifths of Americans, including a majority of young adults. Today, only 29% of those 18 to 34 years old are married, a 30% drop from 1978. Christine Vischer, a professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware, partially attributes this to the increase in financial independence among women.
Prior to the women's movement in the 1970s, women were not a large part of the workforce, and it was expected that women would get married and have a family.
Another change over the last 50 years is that many delayed the transition to adulthood. It used to be leave home, get a job at 18, and marry in their early 20s. But now,
because of the changes, especially with respect to the economy and the need for your education to be able to be higher, to be able to have a good job, people are delaying getting married until almost 30.
Caitlin Rowley is a senior nutrition and dietetics major at the university. Within a few years after graduating, she looks forward to moving in with her boyfriend, but said she would prefer to wait longer before tying the knot.
My dad was 30 and my mom was 28 when they got married, so that is like my benchmark. So when I hear people like, oh yeah, like 25 or 26, I'm like, y'all are still babies.
How old are most couples that get married at St. Mary's?
Well, John, let's go with 28 to 30.
Father Charles Dillingham is the pastor at St. Mary of the Assumption Catholic Church in Hokesson. He works with engaged couples, most of whom are older, to set the foundation for marriage.
If you get married, let's use the age of 27. Let's add those 5 years. So 27 and 32, okay? The bride at 27, the bride at 32, there's not as much growth. That 27-year-old is probably pretty much who he or she's going to be at 32.
Maturity and pre-marriage counseling can make all the difference.
The church has these there for the bride and for the groom to help them understand marriage, to give them all the tools we possibly can for a successful, happy, lifelong marriage.
There is research that shows the later you wait to get married, the more likely you're going to have a stable marriage and you won't get divorced.
John Cassidy reporting.
Thanks to UD Senior Communications Major John Cassidy and his classmates, junior Yusra Asif and sophomore Mia Pellegrino, for enlightening us this week with their features produced during this pandemic. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors John Hurdle and Larry Nagengast, University of Delaware students Yusra Asif, John Cassidy, and Mia Pellegrino, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.